We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 14th day of June 2011. A bit of a rainy old day in Sydney, and it's nice to be back. Today we've got a big program. We've got we'll be speaking to Professor Miles Groth in New York. He's the professor at the Department of Psychology, Wagner College, New York. And we'll be also having a chat about some changes in the recent legislation. But before we get on to those topics, there's been a bit of news. And the first item I wanted to mention is from the Manly Daily on the 11th of June. And there's an interview with a man described as the Bridge Dad. The Bridge Dad said he's a Narrabeen man by the name of Michael Fox. And he's the man you might remember who shut down half of Sydney when he scaled the Harbour Bridge last month. Mr. Fox has pleaded not guilty to climbing the bridge and obstructing traffic, claiming he had a reasonable excuse for doing so. Michael Fox is 38 and he appeared briefly on the 10th of June in Downing Centre Local Court, represented by high-profile solicitor Brett Galloway. The reason that Mr. Fox gave was that for bringing peak hour traffic to the bridge on the bridge to a standstill was that he wanted, as he said on his banner, to please help my kids first. He later told the media outlets that he had not seen his three children since February, but for reasons under the legislation, I presume, he refused to explain his own situation in detail. So he went on to say, in his estimate, there are 50,000 kids each year on top of 50,000 last year, and the next year they're all getting exposed to family separations, and at least half of these are going to go through a troubled breakup. He told reporters he had no regrets for his actions and felt 100% no problems about the court case. So there's a dad standing up for children and for the best interests of the children. I think it's probably good in a way to have people taking extreme actions. I mean, people can help the cause in lots of different ways, and some want to do extreme actions like abseiling down the Harbour Bridge. Others might want to work more quietly, but it probably needs a whole range of approaches to actually get something done in this area. Now, there's also been an article in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 11th of June in which one of our previous guests on this program, Dr. Richard Fletcher, is reported as presenting his results at a conference of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists in Perth, where he spoke about the benefits of intense physical play between children and fathers. Ian, have you got something there on that?
Well, yeah, no, there's an article on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald last Saturday, a large picture of a dad playing with his kids, and the headline is "A Backyard Bliss, Why a Rumble with Dad is Wise." Julie Rowbotham has written, Matt Berry is facing imminent defeat. His sons have pinned his limbs to the ground. His daughter is sitting on his stomach, pummeling his shoulders. If he applied himself, Mr. Berry could throw them off easily, but he is conceding this one. I've struggled with that, he says. I catch myself wanting to win and be the dominant male, and yet I know it's better for them to get a win every now and then. The ability to share the win is the hallmark of positive rough-and-tumble play, says Dr. Richard Fletcher, a University of Newcastle child development researcher who is trying to define what elements of the daddy wrestle most benefit children. Dr. Fletcher videotaped fighting games between 30 fathers and their four-year-olds, analysing the authenticity of the struggle, eye and voice contact, and how the father responded if the child went too far. And he found that fathers who participated most wholeheartedly in wild but good-humoured rough play were more likely to rate positively their children's usual behaviour and social skills. This suggested these children were better able to govern thoughts and emotions and was a first step towards quantifying the special role of fathers in helping children develop coping skills through exploration and testing limits. It's not about IQ, he said. It's about the ability to sustain attention and focus. He said the burgeoning volume of early childhood research had focused on mothers' interactions, especially with very young children, in developing emotional security, and had totally ignored the father's role. So hopefully They're going to be turning that around. About time they started. There's this assumption that fathers are just there to pay the bills and should be kicked out of the house, out the back with the dog, preferably. In fact, if not, just out of the house and out of the neighbourhood and out of the suburb completely and utterly, to let mum get on with it. This view is slowly but surely being debunked.
Well, so now, before we go any further, we better do the introductions. I'm a bit rusty on this.
Well, Bill, you're back. I mean, yes. You said welcome back. We should welcome you back. Bill Cable, welcome back to Dad's on the Air. You've been away for a month and a half. It's been without you.
We can call in the posse. The posse's still out there looking for him, but we found him.
Yeah, well, we found him. Found him out the back lurking around the dumpster.
Yeah, so I'm back, and that's, as Ian mentioned, Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and with me is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, well, good morning, everybody, if you haven't heard me already, good morning.
And Phil York from Dad's in Distress.
G'day, how you going?
And Ray Lenton, also from Dad's in Distress.
Yeah, good morning, folks. Nice to be here again.
And we should mention also, haven't mentioned it yet, but it is in fact International Men's Health Week this week, and it is in that connection we'll be speaking with Professor Groth in shortly. But Phil, I think you've got a couple of events that have been scheduled for this week.
I do, mate. As you said, International Men's Health Week this week, and there is mega stuff happening all over the place, which is really great to see. There is the City Mile Dash in Sydney, which is on June 17, 1 p.m. Location is Bangaroo, Sydney's CBD. The Dash is a fun, challenging lunchtime corporate speed race, and proceeds go to the Cancer Council of Australia. There's a bloke's brunch at Bonnells Bay on Wednesday, June 22nd, just out of the week, obviously, 10 a.m. to midday. There's the Men's Health Conference in Canberra, Men's Health Conference, putting men's health back on the agenda. Let's talk suicide prevention is the topic for this year's Men's Health Conference, which is obviously a very important subject that needs to be discussed when we do discuss men's health. We also have Steve Bidoff doing two talks in Victoria, and he'll be on June 14 at Ivanhoe Girls Grammar School Hall, and he'll be covering his books such as Manhood as well as Raising Boys. So there's lots of events around. There'll be lots of events in all different Bunnings stores over the weekend as well. Dads in Distress Support Services will be attending the Bunnings in North Penrith, and as I said, there's lots of initiatives all over the place for International Men's Health Week.
Well, it's great to hear that it's being taken up, and being taken up around the world, so it's a very worthy cause, and you might keep your eye out for what's happening in connection with Men's Health Week.
Yep, and if you want to find anything else with regard to Men's Health Week, just go on to menshealthweek.org.au, and it's all there.
And I have an article here that's kind of relevant to that. It's, it appears in this morning's Telegraph under the heading Violent Blues, Boozy Blokes Living Longer. Jeff Chambers has written, Australian blokes are drinking excessively, getting into more pub fights and eating too much, but there is a silver lining. Men are living longer. So go figure, people. Go figure. How does that work? An Australian Institute of Health and Welfare report found 11.1 million men suffered depression fueled by sexual frustration and obesity. Sexual and reproductive health is an area of concern to the physical, social and emotional health of males, the report said. Australian men make fewer GP visits than women. Only 40% of men discuss healthy lifestyles with health professionals, and 16% of men do not use any Medicare services at all. So there you go, typical blokes sacrificing themselves for the good of the taxpayer.
Can I just say, Ian, like, that's part of the reason that stat's there is because what we're doing is working. Men's Health Week has been around for a while now. The federal government adopted a men's health plan, I think last year, maybe late the year before. We've been working in this area to engage men. You know, one of the things I thought that was interesting about Michael Fox in one of the interviews, he was asked if he'd ever put his hand out for help, and he said, well, no, we're a bloke, you know.
Blokes don't do that. Yeah.
I've been in theatres of war, blokes don't do that. Well, I'd like to argue that. I think blokes in theatre of war do that. you know, one of the constant things I hear from soldiers is they haven't just got their own body in mind, they've got their mates' backs. And that's what we do at DIDS. We've got our mates' backs. As blokes in the world, we've got to have each other's back, and we need to come together to resolve some of these issues around our kids. We're starting to do that more. Even though a lot of guys don't go to GPs, the amount of guys that do is rising. So we're getting there.
Yeah, no, that's all good, positive stuff. But like it says, we're drinking excessively, getting into more pub fights, and eating too much. Well, I don't know. I didn't know the last bastion. Yeah. But we're living longer, so there you go. So I don't know. Must be some good in there somehow. I guess the spirit of Australian manhood is alive and well, despite years of being under siege.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, there's a bit going on in the federal parliament as well. Their inquiries and submissions are being received in a couple of areas. One is in connection with abducted children. I don't know if anybody was able to watch Late Line last night, but there was an interview with a man, Lachlan Leishman, and Lachlan's child was abducted from Australia in September 08. the mother, by the name of Gina Fagnoli, has gone to Zimbabwe, and it's a situation where there's been no allegation of domestic violence. The family court had ordered had made orders, and the abduction was in breach of those family court orders. He's been able to get some help through the Australian Federal Police and the Family Court of Australia, but he's pushing for a number of experts are. They also interviewed a barrister who was an expert in this area, that the Australian government has to move towards criminalisation of the abduction of children. This is the situation in both the UK and the US, and by making it a criminal offence, not only does it have a deterrent, but it allows you to go to Interpol, and then there's the possibility of extradition in these situations. So we'll be dealing with this issue in more detail in future weeks, but that was on Late Line last night. This particular gentleman, Lachlan Leishman, who's now been without his son for just coming up to 3 years. There's also a submission to the Senate Committee on Legal and Constitutional Affairs by Professor Parkinson, and this is to do with the Family Law Legislation Amendment Family Violence Bill 2011. Now, this is an area where there is a lot of misinformation, and unfortunately a lot of it seems to come from our politicians. There was also a submission by Greg Andreessen, who picked up the Minister for the Status of Women, Kate Ellis, making a series of false statements to the Parliament and to the Australian public. This follows closely on the heels of other officers throughout the country who, for whatever reason, issue these false so-called statistics, and even when they're corrected, as was the case, say, in August 2010, the South Australian Ombudsman issued a report finding that the South Australian Office for Women had published false and or misleading information on the Don't Cross the Line website. But when this was brought to their attention, they failed to correct the information within a reasonable time and with reasonable diligence, and this was resulted in them being picked up in the South Australian Ombudsman's report. So this seems to be a regular occurrence. Kate Ellis has said in what appeared to be an attempt to bring gender politics into a serious debate about an issue that affects the entire community, in the course of her speech to Parliament, she downplayed male victims of family violence by claiming that while it is true that men are more likely to be victims of violence overall, this violence occurs predominantly at the hands of a stranger and in public places such as the street or the pub, not at the hands of a family member, not at the hands of a partner, not at the hands of those they trust the most, and not in their own home. Now, while the Minister is correct that Australian men are indeed more likely than women to experience violence at the hands of strangers and in public places, she seems to have made a jump of logic and or illogic when she because she's unaware that this does not equate to saying that men are less likely than women to experience violence at the hands of persons known to them or in the home. And in fact, if you want the real figures on this, the figures have just been released from the ABS Personal Safety Survey of 2005, and these show that there is no statistically significant gender difference between the prevalence rates for male and female victims of physical assault by known perpetrators in the last 12 months. So that puts the lie to what the minister had said.
And you know, Bill, if you look at the methodology of that research, they actually interviewed half the amount of men than they did women.
Mm.
Because the premise of the survey was that men were more likely to face violence in public spaces, stranger violence. And so they didn't need to talk to as many men to get a cross-section of...
So they'd already decided what they wanted to find out before they even started looking, and it was basically just an exercise in proving what they believed in the first place anyway.
Well, I guess all research is like that to some degree, but I just think it's interesting that they only surveyed half the amount of men because, you know, in a survey, and, you know, who knew it would come out even? Who knew? But now that it has... had we done an even sample size, I wonder what the end result of that would have been.
Yeah, well, we've got a few hurdles to overcome, and fortunately, Kate Ellis was picked up in the debate by George Christensen, who's the member for Dawson, and he gave a colourful but honest and straightforward speech, and he even went so far as to say that this minister has told a lie to this parliament. Of course, he was forced to withdraw that, so he then said that the minister has told an untruth, which you're allowed to say, but you can't, under the rules of Parliament, you can't actually say, call someone else a liar.
Even if they're telling a lie that you can demonstrate statistically is actually a lie, you're not allowed to say, what a crock. What a crock.
It's no wonder.
Water it all down.
It's no wonder the Parliament's in the position it's in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's so pathetic.
You can say a lot of things in Parliament, as we know, but not that that expression that calling someone a liar. So we might have to head off to a music break, and we'll be back shortly with our guest.
Don't you love her ways? Tell me what you say. Don't you love her badly? Wanna be her daddy? Don't you love her face? Don't you love her as she's walking out the door? Like she did 1,000 times before. Don't you love her ways? Tell me what you say. Don't you love her as she's walking out the door? All your love, all your love, all your love, all your love, all your love is gone. So sing along. Deep blue dream. Seven horses seem to be on the mark. Yeah, don't you love her?
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Yeah, and our guest this morning is Professor Miles Groth, who is a professor in the Department of Psychology at Wagner College, Staten Island, New York. Dr. Groth trained as a psychoanalyst in New York, where he's lectured residents in psychiatry on integrating existential analysis with traditional inpatient treatment, and he's been in private practice since 1977. Dr. Groth is also the author of many publications, most recently Best Practices for Working with College Males, which is was available in 2010 from Men's Studies Press. Dr. Groth was also our guest on the program in 2010. Miles, good morning.
Yes, hello. Hi, Bill.
And how are you this morning? Or this evening for
Fine.
You?
Fine. I'm getting my bags packed and ready to head down to Adelaide on Saturday.
Yes, it'll be great to welcome you into this country, and I guess this is part of International Men's Health Week that that this conference is occurring.
Yes, this is work of Dr. John Ashfield and the Australian Institute for Men's Health and Studies, and the day symposium on the 24th of June will include some talk by me and two other speakers. I'm looking forward to meeting people in the area and also catching up with folks I met 2 years ago and 4 years ago when I visited in Australia. So it should be an excellent symposium and launch a lot of additional work and scholarly work and particular that John Ashfield is spearheading.
Well, that's great. It'll be great to welcome you into this country again. And the symposium, I believe the heading is From Boyhood to Manhood, Difficulties and Challenges of Transition. Perhaps you could tell us, I think your own paper it's a quote from Thackeray, the boy is the father to the man, which is a very interesting comment. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about that.
Well, I'll do two talks, and the first of them is takes the title from that quotation you just read, the boy is father of the man. And I am doing a fair amount of research on the topic of boyhood, and that's the major thrust of my work has been now for some years. But my twist on this, my approach that varies from what's been going on most of the time up to this point, is to look at the connection between boyhood and manhood, not from the perspective of manhood, but from the perspective of boyhood, because I think we might have missed some important ways of understanding manhood by not looking first at the way boys experience their lives, not so much in terms of expectations for what manhood should be, we know what that is, but in fact, how is it that manhood has gotten to be as it is, given this unique period of time and status, especially in the 20th century, that we call boyhood. So I see that perhaps looking at boyhood will help us understand manhood rather than the other way around, which has been the approach taken. And the focus of my paper, though, has to be a lot narrower. And so what I'll look at in particular is the place of the father in all of this. The father, there's mention of the father in the quotation, but just in a metaphoric sense. But I'm going to look at the real father and the status of the father these days, especially insofar as the father is increasingly less in the lives of boys, as you know, and what that means. So what I'll talk about in the morning is the changes that have taken place in the nuclear family or the household, especially the disappearance of the father, the large numbers of internationally, the large numbers of boys that are being raised without fathers, and what this means. And I hope that with my slightly different focus to shed some new light on that. So that's the morning session, and the quotation, I think, picks up very nicely something that someone, in this case Thackeray, and a few others have modified that quotation a bit, realized now for well over 150 years, and we're just coming to grips with.
Yes, so you mentioned that this is looking at it from the other perspective. Presumably there are a number of studies dealing with the man, but not the not the necessarily looking at boys and on their route to becoming that man.
Yes, this is so surprising to me. If you look at the literature, it's only within the last perhaps 20 years, 25 years at a stretch, that we've taken seriously boys as separate from, let's say, children as a group, because boys are very different from girls. I know that some people claim that that's not the case, but nearly every parent I've talked to shakes his head or her head in amazement if you say, well, kids are kids, you know, they're really kind of gender neutral. But in fact, it's not the case, and we see very, very large differences, and they've been noted for a long time by other observers, that you can see important differences as early as the first year, year and a half of life between boys and girls. And so these differences we need to look at more closely. That, I think, is going to shed a lot of light on how we've developed our notions of manhood, and particularly how we've gone about wanting to change them. So I hope that this kind of work and this approach will not only reveal some hidden features of boyhood and features of boys, but that this will help us understand manhood and just the way human beings relate to each other in general. I could tell you some more about what's in the paper and develop some of that when I talk there. But perhaps we'll have time to get into some more of the detail of that a little bit later.
Yes. Well, one topic that's interested me for a long time is the transition from being a boy to being a man. And in my own case, I thought it was having a child made the big difference to me. But what would you see as the transition from being a boy and from being a man?
Well, at this point, it's become it's vaguer than it ever was, let's say, in traditional cultures, because we had, in other cultures, rites of passage. Here in the in North America, Native Americans, in your country, indigenous peoples, all of these traditional cultures had very clear-cut rites of passage. So the transition from boyhood to manhood was accomplished within a shorter or somewhat longer, but within a certain period of time, and you knew what that change was, and you were declared a man, usually by your father or by a group of elders, a group of men, and you were on your way. You knew it for sure. But we don't have those rites of passage anymore in this country, and I suspect it would be pretty much the same in Australia. About the only rites of passage for boys would be, let's say, graduating from high school, perhaps, or getting a driver's license. Well, there's hardly very much about that that's significant, and it doesn't have a lot to do with your masculinity. You know, some would say driving your car fast is a sign of masculinity, but no, that's not very significant, and it doesn't set you up for life with other people. But more importantly, it's this. The question is then, well, what do you do in a time when there aren't these clear-cut rights? And the answer is, we don't know. And so boys are, I think, very much adrift at this point. I'm suggesting that even adolescence was introduced into psychology and education and popular culture just only about 100 years ago, that adolescence itself is shrinking, and this is particularly the case for boys, so that you have an extended boyhood that starts maybe at 4 or 5 and now runs through what we used to call the adolescent years. The adolescent years aren't doing what we were told they were supposed to do in the 50s and in the 60s. In the last 30 years or so, that's changed. So there's this long, extended, vague period of boyhood. You have the kind of unusual boy man icon on college campuses and popular culture, and boyhood can extend into the late teens, into the early 20s. A lot of the guys that graduate from the school where I teach are still very much boys in a fundamental sense. So, to your question, we're not sure just now what we need to do to make it possible for boys to know when they have made that transition into manhood. And one last thing, a part of the difficulty is this ongoing redefining of what it is to be a man, and it's really not clear. You ask college age guys, you know, what is it to be a man, and the 21 or 22 when they're graduating, they're saying, well, we really don't know, and no one's telling us, or we're getting mixed messages, and it's really unclear for us. So they're in a kind of limbo, lingering boyhood.
Yes, and there are going to be effects of that. You mentioned before about the increase of single parent settings, and I wonder what you see as the outcome of that. What's going to be the long-term effect of having more single-parent families?
Well, as you know, most single-parent families are headed by women. And I am on record in a number of places now. I just don't think it's possible, no matter how devoted you are as a mother and as a woman, to do the job of a father for a boy. This doesn't in any way put down what women are capable of doing, what mothers are capable of doing, but it says that there's something that fathers have to do and have to do that the mother can't do. So if we, in the States now, we have 2 out of 3 families are now headed by a single parent, and nearly all of them will be headed by mothers. When you have boys in there, they really are missing the presence of a person with whom to identify and someone to model themselves on for manhood. And I'd take it even further, since I think boys learn, and girls too, as a matter of fact. This is just a second, that's a completely different topic, but boys, I think, learn to express affection for other people in this relationship with their father. I mean, this takes some talking out in more detail, but just very quickly, if the father's not there, it seems to me boys miss the opportunity to learn how to be proactive in deep, strong relationships with people in general. I think they learn from their mothers that they're lovable, but I think they learn in this relationship with their father how to be proactive in a strong, effective way, and that this will carry over not only in the relationships with their father, mostly for purposes of identifying with him, but this will also carry over as they see their begin to see their mother in a different way when they get older, and also in their relationships with friends, male friends, and with women, and the partners they're going to have in life. I think it's a major relationship, and if the father-son relationship, if it's not happening, we're going to have some generations of boys who are of men who are males who are not able to relate to other people in a very general way, are not going to have had that experience. Not only are they not going to know who they are, but they're going to have difficulty in relating to other people in very basic ways. That's a finding of my work as a psychotherapist, but it's also something that I've been looking at in a historical context, particularly since the turn of the 20th century, and even more strongly, especially in this country, after World War II. So, to go back to the point of your question, single-parent families without a father, I think we're going to have, we're seeing already the results of this, the consequences of this, and it's very, very bad, not only for boys and for males and the men they're going to become, but it's also, I think, bad for the culture as a whole. It's not going to be good for everybody. It's going to be bad for everybody.
Yes, and we're speaking with Professor Miles Groth, who's Professor of Psychology at Wagner College, Staten Island, New York. Miles, is this where you develop the distinction between what you describe as boyhood and sonhood?
Exactly. I say it some different ways. I think a mother can create a boy, but only a father can create a son. I'm reminded of as a book I hope your listeners will latch on to at some point called The Father, and it's by a psychologist, an Italian-born psychologist, but he reminds us of this ancient practice going back thousands of years, and that is a gesture where the father recognizes, gives recognition to his son. It just doesn't happen automatically. It happens in the context of a relationship between the father and the son. When there's no father there, there's a boy who continues, but he does not really, he's not elevated, recognized to be someone's son. This is, again, not to say he certainly is someone's offspring, but there's something very different in this notion of sonhood. And just briefly, what it's about, I think, is the capacity to then want to move on to be a better man, to be a better father. And so in this notion of sonhood is something about bettering yourself as a man and bettering yourself as a father. Each generation, in a sense, builds on the earlier generation, and perhaps this is one of the ways that culture develops very, very solidly on the basis of this producing of a son by recognizing him. This is my son, and this makes a major difference, I think, for not only the father, but for his son, and in terms of the culture, for the development of better men, and to some extent, that's a really central piece of the way the culture as a whole develops.
Yes. Now, coming back to the conference, I think in one session you're going to be dealing with how you came to be interested in this topic, and I wonder if you could set the scene for us here.
Sure. In the afternoon session, That will be after there's a session by a psychiatrist who will be talking about ADHD in boys, and by just a wonderful woman from New Zealand whom I've gotten to know, Celia Lashley. She's coming for the conference.
Yes, we've had. I just wanted to mention.
Make some recommendations. I'm calling the afternoon session What's a Man to Do? And I want to direct my comments to how to positively develop from the conference what we should take away from it and what we should be able to do. I'm sorry, I just missed the focus of your question.
I'm sorry. When you're answering that, I just wanted to mention we've had Celia Lashley on this program, and she's an excellent speaker, and she's done a lot of research, and she's a very interesting person to talk to. So I'm sure she'll be a hit at the conference. But no, I was just coming back to your own story and how you came to be interested.
Oh yeah, okay. I remember. How did I get interested in this? About a dozen years ago, and I'll just give a few examples of this. About a dozen years ago, I've been teaching for many, many years, and I began to notice that the guys in my classes were just not as with it, not as active, not as talkative. And I puzzled over this. Why were they less engaged? Why were they less involved in academics and discussions? And so I decided to develop a psychology of men and boys course to help answer that question for myself. And that was one of the chief sources of the work, the research that I've done in the meantime. But then, around the same time, things were being published elsewhere, articles in national magazines and a number of books were then being published also about how boys were failing in school and not doing well, emotionally, becoming less often attendees in college. We're now in the United States at 39% males in college. This is from a time in 1981 when it was 50-50, 50% male, 50% female. But in the period of time that's passed, the numbers have dropped considerably. So this was another concern to me. Not only were these guys less involved, but they were disappearing, and I wanted to know why and where they were going and what they were doing. Many of them ended up in blue-collar jobs that disappeared during the recession here. A lot of them have gone to jail. A lot of them are wandering about, and we really don't know where they are. But I see them. We see them working jobs that are not very life-affirming. We see them in relationships that they don't stay with very long. Some get married briefly, some partner, but they're just not engaged. This eventually led to the book that you mentioned, and this I did with Gar Kellum, who is at Winona State College in Minnesota, and he and I, for some years, did some pilot projects at 14 schools, colleges, and universities to see what it was that was missing, that boys in college, young men in college, were missing, and why they were not involved in academics, in co-curricular activities. And so we published these case studies in the book that you mentioned, Engaging College Men, just last year. So my interest has gone from firsthand impressions of boys in my classes to their disappearing numbers, and then finally to the sorts of problems that I was seeing as I worked with them in psychotherapy. That's a whole other area, but the problems have deepened the problems, have changed from what they were, let's say, in the 70s. More boys are being seen. I'm sad to say that, sorry to say that some of them are being seen and not being taken too terribly seriously. There's quite a lot of practice out there that simply writes out a prescription for boys and sends them off with some medicine of some sort, which really doesn't make too much difference in the long run. In fact, may worsen some situations. But finally, to answer your question, was what I was saying in private practice also among boys between the ages of, especially between the ages of 10 and 20, 22, that was reflecting the same kind of problems that I was seeing in the classroom. Mm.
The book you mentioned, Dr. Groth, is the co-editor of Engaging College Men, Discovering What Works and Why, and also the book Best Practices for Working with College Males with Gar Kellum. So, Miles, I wonder, the last session, which we'd like to finish up on a positive note, but you make some practical suggestions as to what we should do next. I wonder if you could run through a few of those for us.
Well, yes, and here I hope some of your listeners will come over to the symposium and participate, listen in and participate in it. But I think I'll just highlight perhaps two or three, a half dozen or more that I'll mention. Men have not spoken up about themselves over the last 40 or 50 years. There have been some men's studies, organizations, but most men have gone silent. So my first recommendation would be that men speak up, and speak up on behalf of, but not for, boys, their sons, their grandsons, the boys that they teach, the boys that they work with in various professional capacities, this is the first thing that men have to say. Look, there is a problem. We men have to be the ones who say there is a problem, articulate it, and speak on behalf of boys. The second thing is we have to listen. Second recommendation is that we have to start to listen to boys. They are more likely to do than say. They are perhaps less convinced that what they say is taken seriously. Maybe there are some, maybe not are, all are as talkative as college professors and the people who work in journalism as you do. You know, we enjoy talking, but a lot of boys don't talk. So I think what we have to do is allow them to talk. We know that when they feel comfortable, and that the right person who's listening, they have a lot to say. There's a wonderful book called The Secret Lives of Boys that's published by a woman here in the United States I know quite well, Melina Saval, and she documents the fact that these guys, and some of them as young as 12 and 13, some 18, 19, if given the opportunity, taken seriously, want to talk about their lives, want to tell us about what's on their minds. And some of it's just heartbreaking. A lot of it is very encouraging and upbeat, and that's what I think we also have to focus on. So that would be my third recommendation, that we look at what's good in what men do, and that we look at boyhood without the automatic presuppositions that so many people make about boys, that we allow them to show them as they really are, that looking for allowing the good things that that men do and the good things that boys do to show through and be heard, I think is very important. That would be my third recommendation. And then finally, I think we have to, given the fact that there are fewer and fewer fathers on the scene, we have to be ready, men have to be ready to mentor boys who do not have fathers. These will perhaps be teachers, these will be people who do what I do in clinical work, people in medicine. But, you know, you don't have to be an expert, and you don't have to do psychotherapy or set out deliberately trying to teach boys to mentor them. And so I think lots of men of my generation, I'm in my 60s now, lots of men in my generation who are grandfathers would be great mentors for boys. So my fourth recommendation of some that others that I'll make is that we have to conscientiously think about becoming mentors to boys in a variety of ways, some of which we haven't even devised yet. We have to think creatively about this. One of my trips there, actually both trips in 07 and 09, I learned about the sheds, the men's mm-hmm. sheds yes. that are there in Australia, and I learned that these are really ideal settings for older men to mentor young teenage boys, and perhaps even younger. So those are four recommendations. I'm by no means am I at this point stuck about this. I think we have to be very optimistic, but there are things that we can do, there are things that we should do, and I think Celia would confirm this, that it's everybody's job, it's going to be everybody's job, but I think we men have to take the lead in this.
Yes, and look, we're running out of time, Professor Groth, but the good news is the men's sheds movement is going strong in Australia still, so you might have a chance to catch up with it on your visit. And if you're passing through Sydney, I'm hoping we might even be able to get together, but I'll be back in touch with you on that. In the meantime, can we thank you from Dads on the Air most sincerely for making your time available this evening, your time, and we wish you all the best, safe travelling to Adelaide, and we hope to talk to you again sometime in the future.
Sounds great. So good to talk to you, and I look forward to coming to Adelaide in just about 5 days.
That's great. All right. Thank you, Professor Miles Groth.
Life for sunshine that never goes away.
grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Yeah, we're back, and we want to welcome Phil York from Dads in Distress back to the microphone.
G'day.
We've got another guest with us this afternoon. His name is Tom.
Now, this morning.
This morning, that's right. It is this morning too. See, I'm still fired up about Channel 7, eh?
Yeah.
They rattled me.
You're stuck in Friday afternoon.
Right? I am. It's a time warp. Tom is with us. Tom is a separated father who unfortunately had a court order made some time ago that isolated him and took him out of his children's lives. Tom's not his real name, for obvious reasons. We can't identify who he is. Now, Tom, you've been doing some work in your area to take some political action to get people to think about changing the family law arena, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct. I have written letters to all the politicians.
Yeah.
And the federal politicians. I've actually sent them. I've actually put wrote letters to all the papers, and I've got one actually letter was published in the local paper, which got a good response from our letters and phone calls and good wishes and pats on the back from people saying that there's a silent majority out there that are looking at all these things that are happening in the community and are speaking about lots of what's going on with the family law legislation and child support. And I've actually got a letter here today from a woman who's gone through that situation.
So how did that come about, Tom?
That was come about by the letter I put in the paper.
So can you just give us a brief outline of the letter that you put in the paper?
Well, if I can be allowed to read it.
That's the letter from the lady that you got back. What did you put in the paper first?
It was just outlining that probably my frustrations of not seeing my children and the way the family law legislation works, the court system works, and then you've got to deal with the child support system as well, because it's what usually goes on in the family law transfers and how much child support you've got to pay.
Yeah.
So the decision that was made for me was that basically I have to wait for my children to see me in the orders. I still have in quote equal shared parenting, although I'm not the I don't see my children. Yeah, it's really weird orders. So I have to now wait until the children want to see me. And then when that happens, I have then have to make another approach to the family law to change my orders for access rights and whatever else. Although I have that now, it's just the way it's been worded.
Okay. So the letter you got back from
the
that
letter
ad
was,
in the paper?
Yeah,
so that was like an open letter in the local newspaper, was it?
It was like an open letter just stating my frustrations, some statistics on how many parent suicide, how many other parents don't see their children, but other parents that pay their child support, do the right thing, but don't see their children. Grandparents, aunties and uncles, friends have come up to me and voiced their opinion of what they want to see their sons or their daughters children, but they can't because of the mother or father, the conflict of interest and all the rest of it. Also parents that are being blamed for child abuse and being violent, but there's no evidence, you know, all those sorts of ramifications that happen.
Okay. So you got a letter back from somebody in the community?
Yeah, and it's a very nice letter, which I'll read. It says, "Hi, just writing to you to let you know that your letter in the paper was definitely needed to be spoken up about. My friend and I read it and agree with all you had to say. My friend, being a grandmother, trying to have a visiting rights through the courts, costing her greatly over those years. Then, this is her son, her other son, unable to see his children because the mother won't allow it. My nephew, 19, pays maintenance from his doll, not much, and plus his children lives 4 hours away. But once again, mother says yes, then no, or he goes to visit and she changes her mind again. His own dad never had contact with him or paid anything towards his upbringing till recently, and the other have a relationship. Thank God for those who want to see their children. Another patron says, as children often feel unloved, abandoned, plus rejected by the missing parent. Having separated from my spouse 8 years ago, it was important that, in commas, our children know the love of both of us. Please keep speaking out, plus encouraging others not to give up. One day the children will know that their parent slash grandparent was trying to see them, which counts for a lot that they've cared. God bless you. And there's a couple of initials, but I don't know who it's from.
Just an anonymous letter. That, now, that's interesting. From a lady, from a grandmother or two, I guess?
Yep.
Yeah, cool.
Yep.
Now, you've written letters off to politicians. Has anybody got back to you, Tom?
Not as yet.
You haven't had a response?
Not a response. So they would have probably received them this week.
Okay.
So yeah. I'll just wait and see what happens with that. But I read to all the politicians in Canberra. There's 226 of them, which contains the Senate and the lower house.
So that's both sides of politics?
That's correct.
And the Greens?
Yes.
Okay, cool. And you expect to get an answer, or what do you think will happen?
I don't know what will happen. We'll have to wait and see what happens.
Okay.
You know, you have to try these things and encourage everybody else to do the same thing.
Okay. So what's the bee in your bonnet? What do you think the problem is?
Just that, you know, our rights as a parent to see our children, you know, whether it's the mother and the father. Another thing I was just thinking about before I come today was each time I went and seen my, I've got a lot of extended family. I've got sisters with, they're all married and all got children. And one of the hardest things for me was to try and answer questions from your younger niece and nephew. And that was really hard. What do you say to a 9-year-old who comes up to you and say, Uncle, where's sus and such? What do you say to a young child that's seen them regularly before and now they don't? And that's really hard. You know, you've got a young child who doesn't understand what's going on because they're so young, and all they want to do is play with their cousins. You know, that really hurts.
It is really tough, mate. Absolutely, and that's just rings loud about how family separation and divorce not only affects the nuclear family but also all the extended family. And as you said, you know, you're talking to 9-year-olds that are innocent and, you know, have nothing to do with this situation, and all they want to do is see their extended family.
Yeah, I think many people didn't realise how much a divorce affects a family. You know, it doesn't just affect the mother and father, like you said, Phil. It affects the grandparents both sides, affects all the extended family both sides.
Yep. Uncles
and aunties and cousins and whatever else. And then you've got their friends in the community of where they live.
Yep.
So it affects a broad range of the community.
And I think it's interesting, and I appreciate that you mentioned it affects both sides. You know, I've worked with families that have come apart on one side because somebody in the family doesn't agree with one or the other's particular, a parent's particular form of action or their process, how they go about it. So it fractures within maternal sides of the family. Sometimes it fractures within paternal sides of the family, aside from the fact that all of those people don't get to see the children along the way.
Mm.
Often it's in within same sides of the family that get fractured as well. So,
you know, I see this situation that Tom is in, and I see lots of dads in my role with Dads in Distress Support Services, where families go through the family court system, and out of that investigation and family reports that are written, it shows that one particular parent is actually aligning the children with themselves. And the problem with this, or, you know, we call it parental alienation, parental alignment, but the problem with this is that the court is there to look after the best interests of the children. Now, the court actually acknowledges that one parent has aligned these children or sided with these children, and then, which is paramount to abuse, but then the court actually places those children, because they've been so significantly aligned and, you know, played with emotionally.
Well, the damage has been done, hasn't it?
That's it. The damage has been done, yeah. And the court sees it and says, okay, there's nothing we can do with these children other than to put them with the abuser.
Yeah, leave them to live in the wreckage that they've created in their lives.
And the other parent that's done nothing gets no time with their children.
Yeah, and they get, like I said, alienated. And in my case, I haven't seen my children for 2 years. You know,
and it feels like you're being smashed, doesn't it? That's how it felt for me. I just felt
gutted, useless, and whatever else. You just got nothing, and you think, well, you know. And then on the other hand, like you were saying about grandparents, you know, how do you explain to them your own personal mum and father who ring up and they're crying on the phone? Why aren't you seeing your kids? Why aren't you seeing your kids? I said, well, the court made this decision, it's out of my hands.
Have you ever been blamed, Tom?
No, I haven't been blamed. It's just like everything goes quiet around you. Yeah. Basically, sometimes, you know, you think, why, you know, it just drives all your friends away and all the rest of it. You know, it just affects a lot and lots of people than you have never imagined.
So talk us through what you think the critical issues are in family law today. When you say you've written to politicians, what are the critical issues that you think the industry needs to look at, that politicians need to look at?
Well, basically, if I can say this, one person, a parent, can say whatever they like, lie, cheat, whatever they want, say all these things and facts, but then the other parent's like guilty as charged with no evidence. I think that's a farce and it's wrong. And, you know, I think, hello, if a parent can allow to this, they're not really looking in the best interests of the children. The children at the moment, some of the children, like you said on the 7 p.m. project, not the
today,
7 p.m.,
tonight.
Tonight
on Friday night.
That child or those children were put in the centre of their mother and father bickering over money. That's totally wrong to me. They should be put out of that situation and the parents sit down and work it out. In that sort of sense.
So I guess you would argue in terms of today, tonight, that show actually reflects something of what is actually happening in the community, that parents are doing that to their children.
Yes, putting the children in the centre when they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Which is, in my opinion, is totally wrong.
And I guess you'd agree with that, Phil. You know, I know, certainly in my involvement with DIDS, I meet a lot of guys like Tom who talk about the fact that they identify inappropriate behaviour around conflict in children from one or the other parent, and the court seems to throw their hands in the air and say there's nothing we can do about it.
Yep, see it all the time, all the time.
So what do you think we should be able to do about that? As a community, what do you think we should be able to do?
Well, as a community, I come down from Wollongong. I have made up a number of boards, and I do a number of protests on my day off at Family Law Court in Wollongong in the main street, and we have got a lot of reaction from a lot of people from various walks of life. It could be a policeman, solicitor, an unemployed person, bus driver, whoever they are, and they come up and they ask questions and say, oh yeah, good on you, mate, all you good, and it's just, I think we have to educate people a lot more.
So you're standing out of the front of the family court at Wollongong?
On the main street, on the council park, yeah.
How often do you do that, Tom?
Once a month.
Okay. And do you get many people come along, like, actually with you, to be there with you?
Yes, it's just me and one other guy. Now we have 7 or 8 guys coming, and more people are coming in and asking questions about what we can do.
What are the placards that you carry say?
Well, there's a number of... I've written them down here. It says, I think... this is probably a good one. How many more children in our society have to suffer because of these laws, which is a big one. In my case, I've put one there, my children are denied their right to see their parent, grandparents. Another one says 50-50 custody regardless of time to benefit the children. Another one says the family law system is corrupt and biased. People probably got an opinion on that as well.
Yeah.
The family law and child support legislation needs to change to benefit the child, which is a biggie.
Yeah.
Another one is also a biggie. What's happened about the best interest of the children? I think that's lost in the court as well. And there's another biggie. Over 45,000 parents, this could be more or less, do not see their children at all.
Yeah.
So for one reason or another.
Where do you get that stat from?
I've read about it.
Okay.
You know, in our right as a parent, you know, children have the right to see both parents. You know, why can't just parents work it out for their children? That's what probably hurts me a lot. And you said to me, what can the community do?
Yeah.
Well, I think the biggie is if everybody got up and went and seen their federal parliamentarian, because there's a federal legislation, federal laws, go to the local office, look them up, go see them, talk to them in their office. Spill the beans how they feel, not just as a parent, but as an uncle, an aunt, a grandparent, a friend. All these people that work in the community see it every day. Go see the federal member. Tell our politicians, you know, what actually goes on and what actually we want. As a load of people, we can change legislation, but we've got to let them know. And more people do it, the better. Another thing is write a letter to them. Send them a fax. Phone and ring them. Send them an email. Now, all this information can be found on the website, which is aph.gov.au.
So that's the Australian
Parliament House.
Yep.
Right, government.au. So
the information that you're talking about there is the numbers, the phone numbers of the local pollies, the email addresses, the fax numbers, where that's their offices are.
And you click on the Who's Who tab. And that, if you click on that, it'll give you a list of all the federal parliaments in Canberra and Parliament House with their name, address, email address, phone number, postal address, everything, and also where their local MP office is.
Yep. Okay. And that's all on the Australian Parliamentary website.
It is. That's correct.
That's not the government site. That's the Parliament House's site that identifies all of the politicians.
Correct, yes. Correct. All the senators and all the members of the House of Representatives. So I'll just repeat that. It's Australian Parliament House. It's aph.gov.au.
Now, the other thing is there's a Senate inquiry going on at the moment. So does it name who those senators are that are involved in that parliamentary
inquiry? No, it doesn't. When I've clicked on the website, it just brings up all their names and like they're the Prime Minister or the Treasurer or who they are in the Parliament, and that's about it. It doesn't say who is related to the Senate or what inquiries they're allocated.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there'd be a tab across the top that talks about parliamentary committees. If you typed committees into a website, you'd be able to identify the number. There are a number of committees that operate in both houses of Parliament, and you'd be able to find the link to the committees, and you can lobby and talk to those politicians probably more specifically because they're involved in the actual review of the new legislation. So what are your thoughts on the family violence bill as it stands, as it's been pushed forward now, Tom?
Well, in my opinion, I think it's gone too far because normal people, normal relationships, every relationship, whether it's a mother or father, have their ups and downs. You have arguments, you know, with day-to-day stuff, it's part of life. I think these laws that they're pushing have gone too far, you know. People do argue, you know, you can have a man and woman in the same room, a husband and wife having an argument about something and it'll blow over and it's finished. But also people have arguments in workplaces and friends and everything else where they have a disagreement of opinion, you know, and that's, you know, that's the Aussie way, I suppose. If you voice your opinion, you get the freedom of speech to do that.
So I guess the part of what you don't like about that legislation is the expansion of the definition of domestic violence?
Yes, I do.
So what would you say to those on the other side of the fence who say that expansion of definition will give fathers an opportunity to talk about emotional abuse and psychological abuse under the banner of domestic violence? What would you say to those people?
Well, there's nothing much more you could really say. You know, it says you just cop it. Like, I've been through the abuse stage myself, and I've had two AVOs on me and one on my father, which all got dismissed, and the last one I had got revoked because there was no evidence, no nothing, which was an actual farce. It's actually, when they do this, there's a score of points in the family law court system. So when I presented mine, it was like, yeah, okay.
I think when we always, or in the past when we've looked at these legislative changes to family law, for some reason it turns into a gender war.
Yes, it does.
It turns into female versus male.
Mm.
And when you look at the crux of family law, it's all about what's in the best interest of the children. Yeah. So why aren't these committees making sure that the central point within their inquiries and what they want to try and find is really valuable in the best interest of the child?
Yes.
So, you know, we're talking about changes to the definition of domestic violence. That's fine. Insofar as I don't see there being too many problems with what they're putting forward. The problem comes from what I see is how the family law court, how the magistrates, the federal magistrates, actually bring that part of the legislation into their cases.
Yes, how they bring that forward.
Yeah.
And I think the depth of it, the breadth of it, is that we bring, you know, perhaps inappropriate at some level behaviour forward, but also human behaviour. People fight, people have arguments, people have disagreements. A marriage should be a robust engagement, a robust argument. We're not talking about those that beat the crap out of their wives or those wives who are abusive in their own right, both their children. Those people who just normally have outs in their family, say inappropriate things at times and apologise for it, where it's just part of the cut and thrust of a relationship, which is everybody, really. And we're going to bring all those forward now as abuse cases to be looked at, intensely looked at, to be taken too much, made too much of, and we move forward.
Let's go to a track.
We'll take a short break, and we'll be back.
Meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Yeah, you're here with 2GLF 89.3. It's 11:50. We're here talking to Tom about some political action that's been taken on the south coast of New South Wales. Ian, you just noticed something in the paper that you want to just mention.
Oh, yeah, there's an ad that's been appearing for quite some time now. Just a little nonsense, really, but just on the aside. This is an ad for Billy Tea that appears in the Sun Herald, and it's been in the Telegraph. And it's a two-thirds page spread. It's a large ad, and it says, "Tea from a time when men were men and women were kind of like what men are now." Now, this is gender, very, very gender specific. I mean, to me, it begs the question, all right, well, if men are now like women used to be like, what are women like?
Yeah.
It kind of leaves that question up in the air. I mean, women, presumably from this, well, they're allowed to be whatever they like. And men are basically turning into a bunch of poofs. That's kind of what I get from it.
Well, because, you know, I guess the change for women was to leave the realms of submissive housewife behind. And so what's that saying, that we're a bunch of submissive, passive poofs?
We're a bunch of housewives. Or we're a bunch of housewives. Yeah. But what are the women? Are they out there digging up the roads with getting a spanner and fixing your car? Yeah. And have they taken over the traditional male roles? I don't think so.
Yeah, no, I don't.
Or is it more to the point that, you know, men these days don't have a voice in society?
Perhaps.
Whereas, you know, it used to be that women didn't have a voice in society, and they felt that they had to uprise and take it to the streets and the rest of it. And now that men seem to not have a voice within society.
And somehow that's supposed to turn us on to buying Billy Tea, is that right?
Somehow that's at the end of the day.
Everybody
they want
up
to buy their
calm
tea.
Us.
Yeah. You know, so the girls are like the blokes used to be.
Yeah, which they are. If you look at the stats around teenage violence, we've got a frightening and growing statistic around female perpetrated violence on both men and women in the community. A horrible statistic.
Yep, we've got lots of teenage girls going out there and cutting themselves.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, but there's violence. A lot that aren't. There's a lot that are growing up, you know, in a traditional way. You know, lovely girl next door type women who are growing up normally and sanely in family situations, who are not going out and committing assaults and cutting them, you know, cutting themselves. And, you know, there's a lot, presumably this is only a small fringe cross-section that we're talking about here.
Well, it's big enough, you know, wander down George Street around 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. Wander down
Mate,
George
I wouldn't
Street,
dare.
Sydney.
I wouldn't dare.
2:30 in the morning, and you wouldn't dare just because of the men that are out, because of the boys, the teenage boys that are out. You wouldn't dare because of the young women that are out there.
Yeah, well, they're all out there, you know, giving it to each other. At a I mean, they've all got knives. I mean, it's not,
and
not
I,
the best
take
environment.
I take your point that it's not all of our young people, but it's a big enough issue that we are, as a community, demanding that a state government takes action, provides stronger policing. We're re-looking at the hours that pubs are open, and there's, you know, pubs that are now held accountable for the level of violence that happens out front of their hotels.
Yep.
I mean, it's a big enough issue that makes it onto the front pages, that the talkback radio shows are always talking about it. Somebody's always mentioning it somewhere. Yeah. So I take your point. It's not the whole of our society, but it's a growing number of young people who are in that state. So I guess the message should be, don't buy Billy Tea, Ian.
Well, I just find it quite fascinating that it's got to this point now where I don't know if that's seen as a laugh or tea from a time when men were men and women were kind of like what men are now. I mean, men were men, so obviously men are not men anymore.
Yeah. Well, maybe that comes down to that the fact there's a in Parliament you've got an office for women in Parliament. Men haven't got that.
That's true.
And I think that's, you know, I thought we all. A lot of women now are trying to strive for equal rights in workplaces and equal money and everything. Why don't we do the same for equal rights for men in for office of men in the parliament and equal rights for the children, for both parents?
And if you look at Kate Ellis, especially history, as Bill mentioned before, she's a propagandist because, you know, most of what she's got to say means nothing. It's just a skewed view of particular statistics across the community. It's just leading the world astray. We can't call her a liar, I guess, but
Well, apparently you can't call anybody a liar anymore. They can lie their guts out. And you can't say you're a liar. And all this nonsense, the best interest of the children.
You can't say that,
that's a lie, mate. The best interest of the children is a slogan that they trotted out to make people feel guilty and selfish. And that's kind of all it was. It was never in the best interest of the children. It's in the best interest of the court and the lawyers, basically. And everyone else can get stuffed. And that is not a lie.
Yeah, that's true. So just can we just go back over what you're saying, Tom? People should go and see their politicians. I would agree with that. I think face-to-face, you know, certainly have a read of every picture tells a story, and you'll hear from the committee that they were significantly impacted by the people who turned up to the public hearings throughout 2004, 5, 6, as that report was being produced by the Lower House Parliamentary Committee. They were significantly affected by the way that people presented and the genuineness of hurt and dislocation of families as they presented across it. So personally go in and see your local member?
Yep, personally go and see your local federal member for Parliament.
Yep.
You know, talk to them that your situation, whatever it may be, where I can't see my cousin Johnny, or, you know, I'm the grandparent, I can't even see my niece or my nephew or my granddaughter because of the way the laws are.
Yep.
You know, that's the only way we're going to get it across, you know.
I guess tell your neighbour, talk
to your neighbour, tell your friends, your family, tell everybody that you know.
Yep.
You know, if everybody does all these sort of things, then things will change.
And if we
people power can change legislation.
And if we look up the parliamentary websites, folks, both the government website and the parliamentary website have a lot of information there about the politicians that are not just in Parliament but who are specifically interested in family law reform. Thanks for being with us today, Tom.
Thank you.
Good luck with your action. I hope people who are interested in listening and in that part of the world come in and join you and assist you in your process. And hopefully we'll see you again the track.
This program you can download from our website, dadsontheair.net. It should be up from this afternoon or tomorrow morning.
We'll be back next week. We care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.